History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should never go untold. They don't have to go untold if we're willing to take a little time, ask a few questions, and listen to what comes back our way. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only do we end up educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We lost a very special member of that generation last week in Las Vegas with the passing of ex-prisoner of war Dean Whitaker at the age of 97. We had the privilege of meeting him here on Hometown Heroes more than a decade ago, but he has been plenty busy in the years since, going to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, learning how to paint, and even writing his memoirs. Dean's story is so special, so captivating, that we're going to make that the focal point of our hour together today. Let's start with how Dean experienced December 7th, 1941 in his native Southern California.
Well, I was working at a gas station Sunday morning. I didn't know anything about it, and somebody come driving in and said, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "No, is it Japan attacked Pearl Harbor?" And that was quite a thing to me because I was that age. Pretty soon I was going to join the service. I was a senior in high school, and the day continued, and people would drive in, and most people were kind of mad. As the day wore on, I heard more and more about what was going on, and it was quite thrilling.
Yeah, it seems like a very interesting place to get the news, and this is in Maywood, California, where you grew up. I imagine a lot of people that pulled in to get their tanks filled up maybe had just heard on their car radio or maybe even hadn't heard yet, and that was probably the only thing you guys talked about.
That's right. And, you know, gasoline was selling for 10 cents a gallon then. That was the cheapest, and it went clear up to 15, 18 cents a gallon, and that was when times were really good.
You know, I've talked to some other people who were in Southern California, I guess a little closer to the coast, like Long Beach area at that time, who, when they heard the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, they were ready for the Japanese to attack L.A. that night, and they were out there looking for for enemy. Did you have any concern that California might come under attack? Was that something you thought of?
Oh, yes. We had air raid sirens. I think the balloons had come over, and we had heard the sirens going off in Long Beach, and we thought, my goodness, you know, what's going to happen here? Anything.
So you were ready to do something about it?
Yes, oh yeah, I was ready. And like I say, I was in high school, and I had three friends that we all wanted to join the Air Corps because they had these nice uniforms, and it sounded really good. So we went down to the old Pacific Electric building in L.A. and signed up. And luckily, I had taken a college course in high school, and I passed the exam for aviation cadet. The other fellas weren't that lucky, but they went in as aerial gunners. The four of us that went in, I was the only one that returned. Thank goodness I made it. But I'd go to a high school reunion and have no friends.
Well, that's the reality of the time that you lived in and the time that you served. So you wanted to be a pilot, I take it?
No, I didn't care what I made. I just wanted to be an aviation cadet. And I went through Santa Ana Air Base at classification, was classified for either one, pilot, navigator, or bombardier. And it just happened that they had the bombardier school was open and they're going to start at Victorville. And I thought, boy, at Victorville, you know, I can commute to home. And it was a short course. I think it was 18 weeks I'd be a second lieutenant. So I said, I'll take that. But they got to the W's and that class was full. So they shipped me off to Kingman, Arizona to gunnery school to wait for the next class. So I went through Kingman, Arizona, got my gunner's wings. The class was ready to start in Victorville, but they had changed that to bombardier navigator, and it took an additional 6 weeks, so I didn't make it. I was very fortunate there because the fellows that I was at Santa Ana with a classification got into B-26s and A-20s, which were known as flying coffins, and I had heard that a lot of those were those fellows were killed. So I was fortunate there that I did get to go to B-17s.
Do you remember the first time you went up in a B-17 and what kind of thrill that was for you?
Oh, yes, that was quite a thrill for an 18-year-old just graduated from high school at Kingman, Arizona. We got into B-17, I think there was about 10 of us, and we took off and we're flying, and I thought, boy, this is great. And we were flying at treetop level, and all of a sudden we were just flying along, and the ground just dropped out from underneath us. We went over the Grand Canyon, and what a sight, having the ground disappear, and here you're flying up in the air. It was wonderful. At the time, we were just starting class, and I thought, well, let's hurry up and get this class done. I did real good at the gunnery school because my dad had been quite a hunter, and we went hunting. I had my first 22 rifle from old Sears and Roebuck's there in Los Angeles when I was 14 years old, and I'd go hunting with that, and he had all kinds of guns, and my brother did. So when I went to gunnery school, they handed me a 45 caliber pistol to see if I could hit the target, and I amazed the instructor because I had shot in my dad's 32 automatic, and I just blasted that hole out of the center of that target. And he says, "You've been doing this before, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah, I've been shooting guns since I was 12. So anyway, at Kingman, I was the head of my class. I had my name put out on the bulletin board when I graduated. And I graduated and got a set of wings, which came in handy when I had visits to Los Angeles when I was in Kingman.
Came in handy how? Spell that out for us.
You know, I was an 18-year-old aviation cadet and had a nice uniform, and I had quite a few dates.
So those wings worked their magic for you. Pretty soon those wings would take you overseas with the 398th Bomb Group. Do you remember what it was like to head overseas thinking, well, pretty soon this is going to be real? No more practice, no more fooling around shooting at targets. This is the real deal.
Yes, England experienced a lot of bombing then, and luckily when we got there, they were all the buzz bombs, and not many bombers were flying over. But it was a thought that, you know, we are now in a danger zone, and we're going to be lucky to come out of this. And at the railroad station, when we were getting ready to go to our base, there was a lot of flyers there that had flown quite a few missions, and they had their medals on, and they really looked great. I said, boy, I sure hope I make this. So when we had arrived at the base, I thought, well, at least they have kind of a good facilities. We had tents that had wood sides on them, and we lived fairly comfortable there.
And by this time, had you started to form a bond with the guys that you'd be flying with? Was your crew able to stay together?
Yes, our crew stayed together. We had our training in Rapid City, South Dakota, where we met our crew and did some flying and bombing around there, practice bombing. So we got overseas. We were all very well acquainted with each other. We had one accident on takeoff where we hit a tractor when we're taking off. This is when we were learning how to fly with the group. We hit this tractor and crashed through a bunch of trees at the end of the runway. We all got out all right. The plane burned up, and I have pictures of that. But one of the tail gunners, the plane broke in half, and he was burnt pretty bad. He spent the rest of the war in the hospital. But this was over, and they put us back in an airplane the next day so we wouldn't get afraid to do that. And so we continued right away in our first mission.
Holy moly. I know that you lived through that, and you've described it a time or two since then, but I'm picturing myself in that situation, and that sounds pretty hair-raising to me. Where were you on the plane, and how did you experience that crash with the tractor?
I was up in the nose, and it was very scary, I'll tell you, having seen that tractor coming up. The fella operating the tractor, when he jumped off of it and run, I thought, man, we're in trouble. Actually, the nose didn't hit it, the wheel hit it, but when we hit the trees, the nose disintegrated and plexiglass was flying, and I had no trouble getting out of the plane because there was no nose. I just went right out with the navigator that was with me. We hit the dirt right away because the 50 caliber shells were going off and just buzzing all over the place. And, you know, they can do some damage when they're going off. So as soon as the fire crew got there from the base, they took us back to check us out. Nobody was hurt except the gunner.
That sounds like a close enough call to me. I mean, that could have been absolutely disastrous for you and for everybody there. And, you know, you hit on being in the nose, and maybe we should paint that picture for listeners. On a B-17, tell us about how many men you have on the crew and where your position was, because you end up with a pretty interesting view on everything.
Being up in the nose, you knew just exactly what was going on at all times. Now, when we were flying a mission, we'd get in clouds and all over the place, and it was a very pretty picture. And it was really nice when you're flying in a big group. The contrails from the planes, what the planes made, were quite eerie. It just lighted up the sky. The place I had as a bombardier was the front seat right by the, there was a turret there, and the bomb site was right between my legs. It wasn't very large, and the navigator sat behind me. He had a table, like a navigation table. And later on, when we were flying, they took our navigator to another crew when they learned that I had taken navigation training too. And they made me the navigator, and so I changed positions. I sat at the table, and I had a nose gunner up at the nose with me. He fired every shot, and just we didn't have much experience. All of our attacks were from the rear. The nose gunner wasn't very busy, but he was there to do if he had to.
Well, let's move on to your first mission, because I understand this was a fairly eventful mission, trial by fire, and I guess you got trial by fire before you even flew a mission with that crash with the tractor. But your first mission, you ended up with a Purple Heart after it. So tell me what happened on that first mission. This was right after D-Day?
Yes, it's right after D-Day when we were trying to make a breakout from the German lines. The Germans had a lot of firepower there, and I guess Eisenhower requested Air Force help, so we went in at a low altitude. We usually flew at about 28,000 feet. On this mission, I think it was at 5,000 or so feet, and every gun German had, it was shooting at us. I could see the flashes from the ground of them shooting at us, and we knew exactly when we flew over enemy lines when all this flashing started, and we were getting hit once in a while. I could smell it every time we got hit, the burning of the material against the aluminum around. And the plane next to us got hit real bad, and it exploded, and nobody got out of that. And it was quite a sight. It lasted me quite a while. But on the way back, just we went over the lines, we got hit again. The instrument panel in the plane and the nose got shot out. And the hydraulic line from the controls is red. And we had this red come all over us. And the navigator that was up with me thought he was shot. He saw, oh, my gosh, this red is coming out of my chest. Well, he rubbed it and found out that it was hydraulic fluid, so he felt great. But in the meantime, when the nose got shot out, I had a face full of plexiglass, and I could hardly see. And it was burning really bad. So we got back to the base, and they took me to the base hospital, cleaned my eyes out. And in the following few days, my eyes were swollen shut. And so I was off flying duty for 2 weeks. And as soon as they healed, I could see again, I was back. I think I missed just one mission because of that. But in those days, you know, it wasn't unusual for someone to get hit like that, and the commanding officer of our base was killed on the next mission, so he had no way to report anything. No Purple Hearts were given. I was visiting the VA here just a year or so ago, and the doctor asked me if I ever received, if I was ever damaged in any of the missions. I told him about my eyes. He said, "Did you get the Purple Heart?" I said, "No." He said, "You're going to get that for you." Well, he did, and 60 years later, I received the Purple Heart at the air base, in, at Nellis Air Base.
What did that mean to you, after all those years, to receive that medal and everything that comes with it?
Well, it was an honor for me because I had received the Air Medal with a couple Oak Leaf clusters and had a few other medals. But the Purple Heart, it is a special medal.
And another special one is the Prisoner of War Medal, an even more exclusive group that I know you're going to share with us about that. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but again, you described that because you lived through it, but the rest of us didn't. And I'm curious, when that happens, when the nose of your B-17, which you're sitting in, by the way, gets shot out, and the plexiglass ends up in your face, and you can't see, and you don't know if you're going to make it home on that mission, you don't know if you're ever going to see again, what goes through your mind? I mean, how did you get through that experience, and what maybe kept you focused in believing that you would be okay?
Well, it was a terrible situation because the plane had gotten hot pretty bad. One engine was out, and one engine was feathering, and we weren't making much headway. And I thought, boy, we'll be lucky to get back to base. But, you know, the Lord is with me, and that really helped.
Amen to that. And I think through the rest of your story, we're going to see that as well. I have to ask you, if you had a nearly fatal crash before you ever flew a mission, and then you got hit in the eyes and couldn't see after your first mission, were you a little hesitant to go on more missions after that?
You know, being an 18-year-old kid, you really are kind of fearless. You think, well, somebody's got to make it out of this, and I'm going to be the one. And you have that attitude that it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude, and you don't scare that easy.
And we're going to hear some more evidence to back that up when we come back with more of this special tribute to Dean Whitaker, who finished his journey on Earth last week at the age of 97. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.com. And you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode this week in tribute to Dean Whitaker, a remarkable ex-prisoner of war who passed away last week in Las Vegas at the age of 97. Before we're done, we're going to hear from Honor Flight Southern Nevada founder Belinda Morris about how much Dean and his example meant to that organization. One of the stories Dean enjoyed telling about the B-17 that he flew in, Stormy Weather it was called, is one mission when that bomber really lived up to that moniker.
It gets pretty cold up there, and we were flying through some clouds that had snow in them, very moist. And a B-17 is a kind of a rattly airplane as far as comfort concerned. And it gets very cold there. Well, the snow was coming through the cracks of the nose, and it piled up a little bit, and the navigator gathered up a snowball and threw it at me. And to this day, he still kids me about having a snowball fight at 28,000 feet.
Not too many people in the world can claim that, I don't think.
No, probably not. It was kind of unusual, but we always kept our sense of humor, and no matter what was going on, we were scared, of course, but we didn't show it.
I'm thinking probably the only other people that have had a snowball at 28,000 feet would be maybe like Sir Edmund Hillary or someone who climbed Mount Everest, huh?
Yes, you'd have to get pretty high and pretty cold to do that.
By the time your 20th mission rolled around on November 2nd, 1944, you had probably gotten into a bit of a groove with your crew, and you guys had found some kind of routine to going up on a mission, coming back, and believing that's the way it was going to work. Is that fair to say?
Oh, yes. Our pilot was an older guy. He was really a good man. He was 26 years old, and he was a first lieutenant. He had made first lieutenant in the infantry and got to join the Air Force at a later date. I don't know. He probably had a lot of medals or something to make that. But he was really kind of a religious guy, too. We would always meet under our plane before a mission, and everybody say a little silent prayer, and this helped.
I believe it, and I imagine, you know, that's different for every person in the military, but it sounds like maybe that had been a part of your life growing up, that you had some awareness or relationship with God or some kind of belief that was going to help you there?
Yes. My parents were Mormons, and we always had that feeling that if we needed help, it was there.
Well, and I think the story we're about to dive into will certainly show that. Tell me about that mission. You're supposed to bomb Merseburg on November 2nd, 1944?
Yes, their synthetic oil plant at Merseburg was a major target. The Germans were running out of oil in their tanks, and that just didn't have enough to really put out a full effort. And so this target was very special. I think every gun in Germany was at that plant. They'd taken them all from Berlin, and the Air Force was the Luftwaffe was the only place they flew was Merseburg, and it was quite a battle. When I looked ahead and saw the flak, which is the black explosion of 88 millimeter shells going off, I thought, Mike, we're going to be lucky to get through this. We got through it fine. We were hit a few times. All I could tell when you were hit that we could smell the burning hot flak metal going through the ship, and we got out of that fine. And as soon as we were out of that, the Luftwaffe attacked us. The first attack, they always attack from the tail because their 20-millimeter cannon would go further than our 50-caliber machine gun. And so the tail gunner was really busy on that first mission. And I think he shot down one of the planes. One of the fellows said, you got one, over the intercom. And so on the second attack, we were hit really bad. The tail gunner was shot bad, and the waist gunner went back to check on him, and he did. He said he's dead. By that time, we were hit real bad, and the plane was out of control. The pilot gave the word to bail out, and me being the navigator, right by the nose escape hatch, I was the first one out. On the way, before I could go out, I had to release. I wore what they called a flak suit, armor vest, and I couldn't. There's an escape tag on that you pull, and it's supposed to be released. Well, it didn't release, and I was fighting that, trying to get that off, and I said, man, I got to get out of here. And, you know, I had a voice kind of. My father had passed away about 8 months before I went in the service, and I thought I heard his voice say, you get out of there now. So I did. I wanted to jump out. I said, I can't wait any longer. I jumped out of the escape hatch of the nose. And as soon as I hit the slipstream, it tore the flak suit off. But my parachute was only fastened on one side because I couldn't fasten the other side when the flak suit was on. So here I was fighting all the way down, trying to fasten the other side. And at 28,000 feet, you have no strength. You're just ready to pass out. And I started entering some clouds at 3,000 feet. And I said, well, I better pull this now, whether it's fastened or not. And I pulled it, and I was floating down, and I could hear shots coming up at me. And the Germans were shooting at me as I was coming down.
And this was fire from their aircraft or from the ground?
Well, that was from the ground. It was civilians in the ground were shooting. They all had guns. And the odd thing about this, when I was, before I hit the ground, I could hear cheering. And I thought, who the heck is cheering in the middle of Germany? And I just about landed in a German prisoner of war camp that held English prisoners. And luckily, a guard from this camp come running out of the camp and made the civilians stop shooting me. They had their rifles all ready to aimed at me, and so they stopped shooting, and the guard gathered me up and took me into this camp, and the English prisoners of war gave us tea and crumpets. It was really something. Four members of my crew were not that lucky. They landed too far away for this soldier to save them, and they were killed by the German civilians, and they later paid for it when the GIs came in, and they had a trial, and I have the names of all the soldiers that did that, and I think they were executed for doing that.
Well, that's understandable, and I'm just struck. We talk about close calls, and you've already described a couple of close calls in the air, but here, out of just the sheer chance of the order in which you get out of the airplane and where you come down, you could have been killed by angry German civilians. Instead, you landed where you were safe.
It was really safe. Then I did notice when I got down that my parachute was fastened on both sides, and I don't know. I had some help there.
So you have no idea how that other side got fastened?
No. It was done.
Well, you talk about somebody looking out for you. That's a pretty clear indication. But that said, while you didn't suffer the fate that your crewmates did suffer, it was no picnic what you did endure. Where did they take you, and how were you treated?
Well, the SS takes you first to interrogation, and they're the worst of all the German soldiers. The Luftwaffe soldiers were really treated as well, but the SS was terrible. And we were taken to a schoolhouse. It was a pretty big battle that day. A lot of planes shot down, and we filled the schoolhouse with about 8 to 10 flyers. And two of them were shot really bad, and we tried to help them as much as we could, but the Germans would give them no help for the first 2 or 3 days. And we were in this schoolhouse, all of us together, and an incident happened there that I'll never forget. The soldier guarding us, he was a Wehrmacht soldier. He wasn't real bad. And he left to fill up his canteen with water once and left us there. And he locked the door and everything, but he left us by ourselves. And luckily, or unlucky for him, he was eating his lunch at the time. And when he got back, his lunch had disappeared. He says, "Who's ate my lunch?" And nobody said a word. But at least we had a little snack there.
And you didn't have to pay any punishment for that?
No, the German guard, they were halfway civilized. We were gone the next day. The Luftwaffe took us in and interrogate us and see where we were from and all that. And then they threatened to keep us until we told them where we were from and what we were bombing and everything. And we knew that all we had to tell them was name, rank, and serial number. And you tell them that, and that was it. And they were going to keep me in there for this cell we went to, had a single cell, and we were going to have to stay there until we told them that. And they had an air raid that day on the town. I think it was Regensburg or something. And I watched this air raid from my cell window, the bars, and it was quite a sight. You know, I was a 19-year-old second lieutenant, and I nothing I could tell them that they didn't already know. And so I was only there 2 days. And then they sent me to Stalag Luft 3, which was their permanent camp for American officers. There was quite a movie made about Stalag Luft 3.
And that's one of my favorites, The Great Escape. What a classic that is.
When I arrived at the camp, I realized that the camp was ran like an army base. We had a colonel was the head of our base, and it was run very strict. If you wanted to escape, you had to go to the escape committee and tell them your plans and everything and wait. But not many people tried that because it was pretty well guarded.
And what were the conditions like there at Stalag Luft 3 in terms of what you had to eat, how your existence was? Did you lose a lot of weight? What was that ordeal like?
Yes, it was something that was expected, I think. The Germans had no food to give you. The American Red Cross served us what we call parcels, and we were supposed to have one parcel a week. Well, we were on half partials, a half partial a week, and later, after the war, we found out that the Germans had the other half. But we got by with that. Breakfast would be a slice of German bread. It was sliced about 1/8 of an inch thick, but it was very heavy. It had a lot of sawdust in it. In fact, I learned later the recipe, they called it sawdust.
Tree flour? I've heard tree flour before, too.
Tree flour, that was it. There's tree flour, and the bottom of the loaves had, you could see the sawdust in them. But it was very filling. And then at noon, we'd have part of the Red Cross parcel had Spam in it. We'd try and have a slice of Spam with the piece of bread. Sometimes the Germans would serve us soup, and their soup was a real miss, stretching the name of soup. If you had sauerkraut, it was the sauerkraut that had been boiled and all the goodies taken out of it, and they served you what was left. And vegetable soup was the same way. It would help fill you up. Then at night we'd have part of the Red Cross food. It might have been Spam and cheese and chocolate bar, and they did serve, it had coffee in it too.
You probably would not be surprised to hear that Dean Whitaker lost 40 pounds in his 6 months as a prisoner of war. But what about his liberation? We'll hear that glorious element of his story, as well as how he met the woman he spent 72 of his 97 years married to. I bet you haven't heard a twist quite like this before. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com, for Central Valley Trailer Repair. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and this special tribute episode to Dean Whitaker, who passed away July 14th at the age of 97. We've listened to close calls that could have taken his life in training and in the skies over Europe as a bombardier and later navigator in B-17s with the 398th Bomb Group. We heard how he became a prisoner of war, and now we can move toward the day he tasted freedom again. But it would not come at Stalag Luft 3. He was marched from there with other starving prisoners, not sure where they would end up.
We're going along this highway, and of course the snow was banked up on each side and you couldn't escape. There's no place to go, and we had the Germans, old soldiers were guarding us. All the young soldiers were still at the front, I guess, and these old soldiers were having a heck of a time carrying their rifles. They would be up on a little bank alongside of us, and one old soldier was guarding us was dragging his rifle. And so one of our men got up there and carried his rifle for him. And the German thanked him for that. So he couldn't escape. There's no place. But we'd stop at different farms and have bread and soup.
And how long did this march go on? How many days and how many miles?
It went on for 10 days. And then we got to a city, and they loaded us into boxcars to take us the rest of the way.
For those 10 days, where did you sleep? How did you stay warm? How did you survive? Because this is the same time. I mean, people know the Battle of the Bulge was going on and how horrible that winter was, and that's not too far away. So, I mean, these are some pretty extreme conditions you're dealing with.
Yes, we would sleep in a farm every night that gets a barn. And we'd sleep in the hay, and in the morning you'd wonder who was in the hay with you. because you couldn't see anybody. You're covered up with hay. And we just managed to keep warm.
So then after 10 days, they put you on 40 and 8s and took you to another camp.
Yes, we got in these 48s, and they were so crowded you had to stand. There was no room to sit. There was a few of the guys who were pretty sick, and we'd make room for them to lay down. One occasion, you know, it was Christmas time, and somebody started singing Silent Night. The whole train caught on to that, and you could hear a trainload of GIs singing Silent Night.
Something tells me that each Christmas now, when you hear that song, you probably go back to that 40 and 8.
Yeah, that's true. It sure reminds you of that occasion, because it was really hard sleeping in those cars, standing up. I think we were relieved two times to get out and go to the bathroom and in those 2 days or 3 days on that train. I don't recall just exactly, but it was an ordeal.
So it was probably a relief when you arrived at your next destination, even though you were a prisoner there.
Yes, we crossed the Danube, I believe it was, and then it got little town of Moosburg. It wasn't a city, it was a town, and we marched through that town, and all the German civilians were hanging out of their window with a swastika. Later on, after we were liberated, we walked by that same town, and all the white flags were out.
That's a sharp contrast, and a very good one on the second half of that. So at this new prison camp, were the conditions the same? Were they worse? And had your morale been impacted at all by all this that you've been through?
It was worse. The facilities were bad. We had no place to sleep. They had put up some temporary tents. And the first night, we slept in an old barn that had so many leaks in it. And I tried to find a place to sleep that wasn't getting dripped on. Couldn't find it. Everything leaked. But the next day, they took us into temporary tents. And this was so crowded. When you slept, you had to sleep on the floor. And everybody was sleeping on the floor, and there was no room. If you had to get up at night, you had to walk over all these bodies. Unluckily, I had dysentery at the time and had to get up a few times during the night. But this dysentery enabled me to go into sick call, which was a permanent barracks that was run by a pre-med student, an Air Force captain. So he treated me, and I'll tell you a little story about him now. On our liberation, well, the first day we saw this infantry spotter planes coming over and knew they were spotting for the artillery. They sighted us and knew we were there. So I think there was 5,000 American officers in this camp. The next morning, we could hear the tanks. They were really making a lot of noise, rumbling. And every once in a while, they'd shoot some. The Germans, was broken up into the Luftwaffe guards, who treated us decently, and SS troops that were guarding us. Two different type individuals. When they heard the tanks coming, the Luftwaffe soldiers wanted to surrender to us. And they started coming into our camp. There was a road leading to our camp from a cheese plant next to us. And the SS troops started shooting their own soldiers that were coming into our camp. And the road coming into the camp, you could see the bodies of a few of them. And they were shooting up our camp, too. And I got into a slit trench we had built, trying to get protected from the shots being fired into our camp. And one of the shots missed me about, 12 inches, I guess. It hit the reeds that were supporting this slit trench. As soon as the tank saw the shooting from this tower, they shot it. And, boy, that tire just blew to pieces by the tank's guns. All right, then that was in the morning. As soon as everything was cleared out, the tanks came into camp. I have a picture of the soldier, the infantryman, shooting the lock off of the gate to the camp. And behind him came the tanks. Were we ever glad to see them? Then, I don't know what the time was, and then a little bit later, after the tanks, General Patton came in. I was in sick bay, which was in the first building, and I was standing at the stoop waiting to greet them. I didn't know he was coming, but he came over to the stoop, to the camp, to the door where I was, and asked me, he says, "How you doing, son?" I says, "Fine now that you're here, General." Well, he was there to see his son-in-law, the medic I was telling you about. It was his son-in-law. His son-in-law got hit by one of these stray bullets, but luckily it had gone through the building and was pretty well spent. They did carry him out, but he was fine. And so General Patton took him with him and disappeared. Another thing that was quite an occasion for a lot of people, one of the captains on the infantry that liberated us, his brother was in our camp, in our tent, and he was going to really treat him. He took him out and shot a deer, brought the deer back, and was going to really treat the guys in that tent for venison dinner. Well, we all got sick. It was just too strong. We didn't eat much of it, but what there was, we were not used to that. So there was another occasion where that afternoon a donut truck came in, a Red Cross donut truck, if you can imagine that. They didn't have any donuts. You know, we tried to bum some donuts. Oh, no, we already gave away. But one of the Red Cross workers in the donut truck, her husband was in camp, and you should see the reunion.
And I'm sure when you watched those reunions, you imagined your own.
Oh, yeah, we were ready for that. They were real careful not to give us anything to eat that was going to bother us. We had bread and soup. It took about 10 days for them to get ready to fly us out. They took us by truck to an airport, went by some of the concentration camps, and we saw the prisoners in their striped suits just mulling in the streets, wondering what they were going to do. We went to this airport, Luftwaffe airport. We were sitting there waiting for our planes to take us to France. German plane came in and landed. I think it was the ME-109. We watched him land, and he got out, and this woman got out with him. He escaped from the Russians, brought his wife, and landed in there for the Americans to take him prisoner.
It gives you a sense of the desperate times that you were living in. And I look at your wall here in your home in Las Vegas, and you have a very well-preserved document, the docket with German text and a picture of a young American POW with his fingerprint. How did you come to possess that paper from the German files that documented your captivity?
When the war is over, we could do pretty well what we want. Well, I went to the headquarters of the Luftwaffe there, and it was in all a mess. You know, they'd taken all the files and scattered them over. Well, I found this German ID on the floor, a picture of me. It was my ID, and I said, gee, I'm going to keep that. So I did, and I still have it today. The writing isn't German. I can't understand it, but the picture is me.
No doubt about it, and they spelled your name right. When you see that on your wall, and it's not too far from your Purple Heart or your Caterpillar Club for bailing out of an airplane, the wings that you wore, and a picture of your crew. But when you see that picture of you as a prisoner of war, what does it mean to you? Does it trigger something in your mind? Does it have a significance to you when you look at that?
Oh, yes, it sure does. It just reminds me how fortunate I was to escape that and to live a nice life afterwards.
When you came home, and I know you sailed into New York Harbor, and I've heard a lot of people talk about what the Statue of Liberty meant to them at that point, but did you feel you had a new lease on life or a new outlook, a new determination to do something with your life that you almost lost?
Yes, yeah, see, I just turned 20 in a prison camp, and I always thought that I had a good future, and I wanted to be an architect, and so I was ready to go to school. When we went through New York Harbor, and the fireboat come out and sprayed and really celebrated, I felt, well, we're home.
And you would end up back in California. A girl named Lucille caught your eye?
Yes. I was going to church one day, and Lucille, my future wife, was there, and she had lost a boyfriend, was in the Air Force, and his plane got shot down. It blew up. Nobody escaped. Well, they'd have prisoner of war meetings and missing in action meetings in Los Angeles, and my mother would go, and Lucille would go to see if they'd heard from her ex-boyfriend, and so they got acquainted. So when I came home, Mom said, you got to meet this young girl. She's really something. And so I did, and met her and married her.
And I guess I skipped over your reunion with your family. And they probably for 6 months had been not knowing if you would come back, had gotten telegrams and didn't know what your fate would be. What was that moment like when you got back and saw your family again?
Oh, it was really nice. I had three uncles that worked for the Pacific Electric in L.A. All three uncles were there with my mother and my sister and my brothers to greet me at the railroad station, and it was quite an occasion.
And you talked about meeting Lucille and marrying Lucille, and I've seen your wedding picture, and that beautiful white dress that she's wearing had a unique source of fabric.
Yeah, she wasn't able to get a wedding dress then. There was no cotton or anything, and everybody's getting married, it seemed. And she's going to have to wait a year. But there's this retail house in Bell that was selling old parachutes. And so she got one of her friend's mother to make her a dress out of this silk material from a parachute. It turned out really beautiful. But this parachute came from Cole of California that made bathing suits before the war. My mother worked for him. She probably had something to do with the parachute I made. It's weird how things turn out, you know, but everything turned out so well for me, and I have our God to thank. I did feel that I had things to do in this life and that I was going to give the opportunity to do them.
And he was busy doing them all the way up until his passing last week at the age of 97. Dean Whitaker, what a story, what a man. That interview was recorded way back in 2011. A couple years later, the Las Vegas area launched its first honor flight to take World War II veterans to Washington, D.C. to see their memorial. Dean Whitaker became a special part of the Honor Flight Southern Nevada family, as we hear from the founder of that special nonprofit, Belinda Morse.
Well, Dean Whitaker was a World War II veteran who had the soul of a saint. For even though what he went through during the war and being a POW, there was no bitterness in the man. He just had that kind of sweet soul. And so for us, he became part of our family. Many of the members of Honor Flight just developed that relationship with him. Those that went on the flight and then that got to know him at the flight reunion and some of our pancake breakfasts that he would come to afterwards. He's just that kind of guy. One of our team members ended up helping out with his care. Another of our members, her and her husband, helped get his book published. So they worked together and they kept in touch with his caregiver as he went through this, you know, his decline. Have just kept in touch with him. He became a part of our family. There wasn't anyone on the team who didn't know who he was, didn't help him like throw the first ball out at an Aviators game or come to a basketball game and get his service recognized.
And, you know, as I hear you say that, I'm thinking about how many seniors, how many people in his age group and even younger end up so alone, don't have a network, don't have a family, don't have people who are out there caring for him. And it just hits me. Maybe we get desensitized to it, and you do being around Honor Flight all the time, but that's pretty a pretty unique and special role that Honor Flight Southern Nevada is filling, isn't it?
I think so. His family, his you know, core family didn't live nearby, and many of them had passed away, his wife and passed away. So he lived alone. He did have a caregiver, Bruno, who came in and took a lot of care of him. But many times we would go there, he was just by himself, painting. He became a painter. I don't know if you knew that, some beautiful artwork. So yeah, he didn't feel like he needed anybody. But Honor Flight, the role that the Guardian plays, because we do one-on-one Guardians with everybody, they build a great relationship with their veterans. And we have many that don't have any family. And so that Guardian becomes a great friend and a part of their family. And they keep in touch with their veteran, cards and letters. I hear stories all the time from our Guardians. Oh, I'm taking my veteran out to lunch. And it's not uncommon for us, like you said, to fill that role of someone special in their life after the experience they have together in DC.
And I'm glad you could shed some light on that, because, you know, Honor Flight began as a mission to take vets to their memorials. But the longer it goes on, it seems like the more it becomes, and things you don't even plan for become a significant impact of what you're doing.
Right. We take a small group. And that's just kind of the thing that we've grown to enjoy most about it. We take 25 veterans and 25 guardians. And what that allows is those veterans to get to know each other better. It's not a big, overwhelming crowd. They have more time together. And so they reconnect with someone from their peer group that they may, especially the World War II veterans. Our two World War II veterans that came on our last flight didn't know each other, but they were just buddies by the end of the trip and looking out for each other. It's amazing what comes out of the trip. Like you said, that wasn't the original mission of the Honor Flight program, but what it becomes for these veterans is so much more. And I think as people who work within the Honor Flight program, we're almost every trip amazed at what comes out of it that is a bonus to what the trip is.
And I want to ask you about when your next flight is and how people can help if they're listening and want to, but specifically to Dean, and I know you've heard a lot of veteran stories, but specifically to Dean's story, was there an element of it, something that he shared or you read or you heard that just really kind of made an impression or grabbed you?
Well, when he talked about his time as a POW, I believe he said it was 7 months, I think he was a POW. Just listening to that for our generation, I think, and certainly the younger generations that hear that story, it's just shocking to hear it from a person who was really there and experienced that kind of starvation and treatment that another human being can do to another human being. And as I was saying a little earlier, sometimes you would expect somebody to go through that, to have this level of bitterness and this distrust of humanity, and Dean didn't have that. And I think that's one of the biggest things that struck me about Dean is what he went through, but he never failed to have a smile on his face. He was that kind of man.
And as far as Honor Flight Southern Nevada, when is your next mission? And if people want to support that mission, how can they help?
So our next flight is October 14th, 15th, and 16th, and we'll be taking 25 veterans on that flight. If you'd like to support us, we can always use donations at honorflightsouthernnevada.org. There's also applications on there if you'd like to apply to go to as a guardian on either this flight or our future flight, and or volunteer to help us make these flights possible.
And you're all volunteers?
We are all volunteers. We have a board of, I think, 10. We have 10 board members, and then we have a 10-member operations team, and all of them are volunteers.
And, you know, anybody that comes to Las Vegas realizes how much the area has grown, not just population. You know, now there's an NFL team, there's an NHL team, we're probably going to have Major League Baseball and the NBA before long. Does that translate to increased applications and a greater need for the work you guys are doing?
I think one of the biggest needs is people move here to, believe it or not, the weather. You know, not right now. They're not moving here for the 110-degree weather. But we just don't have a lot of fluctuation in weather most of the year. It's pretty, you know. So the growth in population has increased our veteran application regarding Vietnam veterans. A lot more Vietnam veterans, and applications come in all the time. And we're the closest hub to some of the places in northern Arizona, southern Utah, and so we also serve those small towns where we're the closest honor flight.
I know this isn't an easy question, or maybe it is. How long have you been doing this now?
9 years.
And how long are you going to keep doing it?
I don't know the answer to that. I guess as long as the money keeps coming in and the veterans keep wanting to go, we'll go as long as we can.
And is there anything else that you think people ought to know about Honor Flight Southern Nevada or the veterans that you have the privilege of serving?
I think people should know what Honor Flight means to these veterans. Even the most stoic veteran who will say, oh, I don't really need to go, will come up to us at some point during the flight and say, I'm so glad I came. Thank you for this opportunity. And it means the world to them to be recognized and for their service not to be forgotten. It means a lot to them.
Well, I want to say thank you for your example of serving all these veterans. And on a personal note, thank you for introducing me to so many of them and their powerful stories. But I'm wondering, you just told us what it means to the veterans. I'm wondering for you personally, do you see something in your life now after doing this for 9 years that wouldn't be there or wouldn't be there quite the same way without what you've gotten from everything you've tried to give?
Well, my father was a veteran and my husband is a veteran. And I would say I've always been very passionate about the military. But most recently, I went to D.C. in June. And my father passed away from the impact of Agent Orange after being exposed during the Vietnam War. And they had a memorial service in June for veterans from Vietnam who were impacted. And I don't know that I would have thought about honoring my dad in that way if I had not been around Honor Flight and seen, even though he's passed, that it's important to recognize his service too. So Honor Flight had an impact on me to making sure my father wasn't forgotten.
Again, that's Belinda Morris, founder of Honor Flight Southern Nevada. You can find links to that group at hometownheroesradio.com, where we have some photos for you, too, featuring the late, great Dean Whitaker, who now is reunited above with his precious Lucille. Thank you so much for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, echoing a refrain that Dean Whitaker understood more deeply than most of us ever could. Freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.